Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. It's the 15th of October, 2009, and you're listening to In Touch with Carl Jung. Today, Dr. Scott Sparrow talks about lucid dreaming with Elsom Eldridge, Jr. From the Centerpoint Foundation, producer of the Jungian programs Centerpoint and Questpoint, Elsom Eldridge, Jr. and Phil Lynch talk with various psychologists and hypnotherapists about the work of Carl Jung every Thursday and Tuesday, 10 a.m. on blogtalkradio.com. I'm Ken English, the producer and host of the show. I'm the Blog Talk Radio guy. With that being said, it's time for Elsom Eldridge, Jr. and Dr. Scott Sparrow talking about lucid dreams on In Touch with Carl Jung.
Welcome, Dr. Scott Sparrow.
Well, thank you.
So good to have you on the show today. Oh, and before we end, I want to make sure that everyone, well, let's even not wait. Let's share what your website is, because I want everyone to have the same experience I was able to have, which is go and just sort of drink of the rich material you've got there.
Well, thank you. It's spiritualmentoring.com.
Just so many terrific articles that will enrich the lives of people that read them. And the books, I haven't got your books yet, but I've ordered them. I mean, I'm just so intrigued, and I want to know so much more, which this is why we're here today. But before we get into talking about lucid dreams and the various areas that I want to know so much more about from you, share with us what you're doing now, and then a little bit about how you sort of got into this whole arena that's so exciting.
Okay. Well, I guess my bio would shortly read. I'm a professor of counseling at a university in South Texas, psychotherapist in private practice since, all the way back to 82, so I've been practicing since then. And I've written several books, as you mentioned, and I'm a fly fishing guide, of all things, on the Laguna Madre, which is my home waters here in South Texas. So I wear several hats and enjoy all of them.
that's wonderful. And you and your wife have an inn there, I read, as well.
Well, we co-founded it and started it, but now we've moved down the river, and now I guide for the inn, and I'm their webmaster and primary guide. So she's teaching with me at the university full-time, so we have more of an academic focus now than we did 10 years ago when we started the fly fishing inn.
Interesting. Well, let's go to how did you happen to get involved in this meditation, this dreaming, this whole arena?
Well, I had a friend from childhood whose family was into the work of Edgar Cayce, and she would often talk to me about it, and I would ridicule her because he talked about reincarnation, and that was a big red flag for a lot of people. But after I got a little more mature and interested in spirituality, I joined her in a study group in Austin, Texas when I was a freshman at UT and started meditating on a daily basis with people there who were studying Jung and Eastern religion and the work of Cayce and other metaphysicians. And I just almost immediately started having deep mystical dreams, out-of-body experiences, and lucid dreams, even though I didn't even have a word to describe them at the time. And I ended up doing some research on it, and within a couple of years, I did a master's thesis called Lucid Dreaming as an Evolutionary Process, in which I tied the phenomenon of becoming conscious in the dream state with Jung's notion and some of his students theorizing about the emergence of consciousness in the primitive world. And I thought that the same thing was happening in the dream state now as happened, you know, 30,000 years ago. So it started with my own mystical experiences, but it began to be a life work of writing about dreams and higher states of dreaming and meditation and those things.
And is that what you would say accounts for your interest in dreams and meditation? The fact that you were in a
study group?
Yeah.
Partly. I also had been doing mandalas for years spontaneously, and I didn't know a thing about them. And one of my roommates said, hey, you should go read the work of Carl Jung. And who's that? So I ran down to the bookstore, and they had one collected work of Carl Jung, and it would happen to be the volume that had the mandalas in it. Volume 9, is it 9-1? I forget.
Yes.
Archetypes in the Collective Unconscious. So I bought it thinking I had all of his work. And I ran home, and I started getting into Jung and reading about Paracelsus and alchemy and all of these rich resources. And it segued into my dream life, too. So Jung was right there at the beginning of my lucid dreams and informed me in many of my encounters in the dream state.
As I was listening to you describe this, now, if you had not had a lucid dream or an experience of that nature while you were learning about them, you would still have probably an interest in meditation.
Yes.
But it might not have moved further.
That's right. And it shifted me in a direction that most lucid dream researchers did not take. And it was in the direction of using the lucid dream model as a way to help people heal in psychotherapy. So
There's a story there, I'm sure.
Yeah. Once again, coming out of my own dreams, I started having powerful encounters with shadow figures and anima figures in the lucid state. And I realized that becoming conscious in the dream was not just a fanciful way to explore your own ego gratification, but it was an opportunity to come into relationship with some pretty powerful forces. And so I began to argue against the idea of just, you know, getting your pleasure fulfilled through becoming conscious in the dream state, and instead working toward this dialogue or conversation with these powerful archetypes that needed to have their agenda honored.
Agenda honored. That takes some thought too. I want to go back to, let's explain to, there might well be listeners that are wondering, lucid dreams, what are they talking about?
Right. Well, a lucid dream is simply the experience of becoming aware that you're dreaming during the dream. A lot of people think it has to do with dream control. So they think it's synonymous with controlling your dream, but actually it only has to do with being aware that you're dreaming. And what you do with that awareness can go in any different directions. Partly, what some people argue toward controlling the content, I have always argued toward controlling your response to the content. So
right.
A little different.
Like the opposite, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
If Jung were alive today, and he could treat consciousness in the dream state as sort of a desirable thing, or do you think he would urge a yellow light or a red light on this?
Well, I think he would smile and nod, and he'd also say, "Get ready." a Jungian analyst by the name of Edith Wallace, who is deceased. She lived in New York. She heard about my lucid dreaming, and she smiled and nodded, and she said, "I hope you have your circle of fire around you, your ring of fire." And I thought, how negative of her. Well, as it turned out, she was very prescient. And I think Jung would have foreseen both the rise and fall of my own trajectory, that it became necessary for me to come into some pretty sobering confrontations with my own kind of unfinished business and deep shadow issues. So, you know, it's as he said, there's no birth in consciousness without pain, and every birth in consciousness is experienced as a curse. Well, I think once again he'd smile and nod and say, you know, get ready.
Now, you got ready in a in doing some meditating, well, getting used to meditating for quite a few years before this happened, right?
Yes, I had been meditating up to 2 hours a day. It got to be pretty customary for me to meditate for 2 hours a day in my 20s. And that, I think, was catalyzing this lucidity and this deep stirring of radiant experiences. But also it was catalyzing a necessary encounter or confrontation with a lot of things that I hadn't been aware of. My own deep grief and sense of abandonment and issues out of my childhood. So the meditation, I think, helped me weather it. And I argue in my presentation that I'm doing this week for the Journey Conference that we need both a transcendent and an incarnational path, that we need to be able to go to the mountaintop in our own meditative work or whatever yoga we're doing to get some constructive disengagement from some of this. But also we have to enter back into it. We can't just float away. And Jung was very aware of the dangers of a Western psyche floating away or trying to float away and getting kind of brought up short by the retaliatory forces of the unconscious. So I think the tandem work, the meditational work and my dream work, were two sides of the same journey that helped me, you know, not that I'm there, but, you know, helps me today get through it all and get more whole in the process.
Can you share with us some of the dreams that occurred that sort of moved you along and
yes.
and helped guide you, I guess?
Well, I'll share two that come to mind immediately. The first one was the experience of light, the first experience of light I had, and it was right after I started meditating, and I became conscious in the dream. It was my first lucid dream. I'm walking home from school with my books in my arms, and I suddenly realize I'm dreaming, and I look around, and everything is more real than ordinary life. And I said, this isn't a dream, which is somewhat paradoxical. So I went up to these black double doors that had brass handles on them. And it was my house, even though, of course, it looked nothing like my apartment. And I opened the doors, and as I did, light came through and infused me. And I was thrown into a state of ecstasy, just complete joy. But I was by myself, walked into this chapel with windows overlooking desert plains, beautiful, beautiful place with plants and light everywhere. And so that was the beginning. The question that came in the experience is, why am I here? What is my purpose in life? And who needs to inform me? And no one was there. So that was the beginning, and of course much happened afterward. But to bring it down to earth and show how I began to have to face an ordeal or an initiation, not long after that, I dreamt of a deceased friend who appeared in my dreams for many, many times over a period of about 6 or 8 months. And this character had been a very violent but good friend, but he'd run into trouble with the law, and he died in a car accident, and just really living on the edge. So in the dream, he, classic shadow figure, he wanted to kill me, and he would chase me, and I would run and try to wake up, and I realized I was dreaming. I became lucid, but it was rather impotent, didn't have much effect on him. And so this happened several times until finally I, in reflecting on what was happening, I thought, this must be my shadow, but what's going on? You know, what is the issue here? I kept being afraid of it, but having Jung in my life helped me a lot to realize it probably was not, you know, a fatal experience. It's something that I was being confronted with. So not long after that reflection started, I had a dream with him again. He's chasing me again, and I suddenly realized he's dreaming. I'm dreaming. And I turn around and I say, you're only a dream. May the light of Christ surround you. Go away. Well, he didn't go away. And, you know, looking back, that was pretty pitiful, because all I was doing was dismissing my shadows of the legitimate grievances, I suppose. But he just laughed at me, showing the integrity of the self. He pulled a knife on me and he said, I want to show you my new knife. So completely undeterred by my lucidity, he came after me, and I pulled the knife somehow and fought him. And I was able to disarm him. So I thought, maybe that was it. Maybe that was the end of the dream. No. Soon after that, here he comes again. And it's like each step of the way I would develop a response and enact it, and it wasn't good enough. So in the last dream I had with him, last one I've had in this lifetime as far as I can remember, he had me down. He was trying to kill me. And all that I'd done up to that point didn't seem to be very useful. So I was trying to at first to get away, and then I realized I couldn't get away. So I freed my arm, and I reached up, and I just stroked his shoulder. And as I touched him, he started crying, and he said, I only want to be loved. And so that was the end of that, and it just really represents some of the ordeals I've faced in this whole kind of waking up and trying to, you know, be spiritual, but also the need to become whole and be integrated with some pretty deep issues that haven't been at rest in me.
I'm hearing this for the second time, which is why I asked for the relating for the audience, because it is so powerful. The number one, what you experienced, and if it hadn't been a lucid dream, it would not have had any impact at all, perhaps, other than when you woke up. And
well, you know, the last dream wasn't lucid. I wasn't aware I was dreaming when I did that. And I think sometimes it's more important not to be lucid, because then your response in the dream is life or death. It's not, you know, you don't have an exit. And so in that moment, I had no choice. I had, you know, either to fight back or to die or to do something. In that creative moment, I don't know how I drew on my resources to reach up and touch him in an affectionate way or a kind way, but it just happened. It was just remarkable. So,
yes.
Yeah.
So, looking at your approach to dreams, well, and Jung's approach to dreams and dream work, and your model of dreams as indeterminate from the outset and sort of co-created, I think that's the word, through the interplay between the dreamer and the dream content, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a relationship between what Jung's approach to dreams was and this one?
Well, I think Jung was positioned historically to do the work he did. His whole discovery of the collective unconscious and his reaction essentially to the reductionistic approach of Freud and earlier people, I think he did his great work by focusing on the content of the collective unconscious and, of course, the destiny of the soul, the forward-looking dimension of our becoming ourselves. Now, he did make a statement, and I don't have the quote right here, but many of us have read this quote where he says that the inner image cannot be understood as just a product of the unconscious, but has to be understood in reciprocal relationship to the dreamer, to the self. And that statement forms the foundation of my approach to dreaming and dream work now, because what I think he was saying, and he didn't really develop it much at the time, because once again, I think he was focusing on his historical moment and his greater contribution at the time.
Right.
That what I was able to take from that is the dream is created, not just the image, but the whole unfolding experience is created through the interaction between the dreamer and the dream content, or the emergent agenda, whatever that is. And Jung talked about the archetype not being an image, but being a pattern. So the image, in a sense, is formed through the interface between consciousness and the creative, you know, emergent unconscious issue. And What I've done is consider the dream as an unfolding experience, a relational experience, which is indeterminate from the first moment, but takes form as the dreamer responds in a variety of different ways, emotionally, cognitively, behaviorally, to whatever's coming at him. And through that response, the imagery adapts, adjusts, comes back, and is co-created, so that the whole outcome of the dream is a creation of the dreamer and this agenda. I don't know what to call it. You can call it content, but it's kind of abstract.
Right.
And I think of the agenda as both backward-looking, you know, the unfinished business of our lives that hasn't been resolved, like my Benny dream, the dream of the man trying to kill me, but also the dream of who we can be, which, of course, we're all in. We're resisting that, too, most of us, in spite of what we think. And so as the dream content comes to us, we can either facilitate its healing or integration through our response in the moment, or we resist out of ego, status quo fears, and we just thwart that process. So by working with dreamers to understand how their response was so crucial in the moment of the dream's emergence, and they can go back to that, rethink that response, then they actually participate more actively in the individuation process, as well as the healing process, looking backwards. Whereas just to analyze the dream content from the question of what does it mean keeps the dreamer somewhat removed from that empowering stance of knowing that what I do in the dream affects and modifies the dream content.
Are there other examples that you can share with us that of others that where this has been such a important experience?
I may have This was a client of mine several years ago. She had been molested as a child by her stepfather for many years, actually, and finally stopped it herself. But in the dream, she dreamt she was in a bed, and she's by herself, and she looks up, and the ceiling has holes. And through the holes were coming these big Norway huge gray rats, ugly. They're falling down through the ceiling onto the bed. She jumps up in fear and runs out of the room trying to get away from them. They seem to chase her in her experience, but she comes into the foyer of the house and sees the stairway and begins to run up the stairway. She gets close to the top of the stairs. So far, this is a pretty classic, you know, nightmare-type dream, which easily can be related to her life experience. But something happens. She turns around to see if the rats are chasing her. She sees one coming up the stairs, and she stops and looks at it and notices that its fur is lustrous. And she's just transfixed it. And the rat is standing there looking at her. And she wants to touch it. She leans over and touches the rat's fur. And as she does, it changes into a snow leopard.
Ooh.
And she's just amazed and astounded and wakes up at that point. Now, the content is compelling, and it's easy to analyze the content and get all kinds of meaning out of it, but the way my approach to dreams looks at this is that, and this may seem obvious to people, but in a lot of dreams it's not so obvious, but what the dreamer does or doesn't do is so critical. Her turning around, her willingness to look at the beauty in that ugly threat was so transformative in and of itself. She was doing therapy at the time, so one can imagine that maybe a lot of the work she'd been doing was now trickling into her new response in the dream.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a life-changing moment. She reaches down and touches that fur. She is affirming something in herself that's been so loathsome to her for so long. And, you know, you have to celebrate that. And, of course, by remarking and by focusing on the dreamer's response, you begin to empower the client or whoever is the dreamer to do more of that, to think in those terms, to think in life in those terms, that maybe this situation I'm in could be modified, not by changing the conditions out there, but modifying my responses to them. Of course, that's very empowering. So it does map onto the waking state very beautifully as well.
You said that you believe that the dream is not so much a message as an initiation which the dreamer must respond to in a particular way. What do you think is the best, let's say, evidence for this idea?
Well, that particular dream is a good example that it would have been just a chronic nightmare, and it probably would have repeated itself. But when she was able to respond in a new way, she breaks the cycle of escalation, of being, assaulted by something within herself, maybe her instinctual nature. We could sit here and talk about what these rats represent, her sexuality, and certainly be on target. But the response to the dream was transformative. And the response to my Benny figure, the man who was trying to kill me, was transformative in many ways. So I can look at more subtle dreams and show you, and I do all the time with my clients, and look at little places where they did respond with confidence, with creativity, and begin to underscore that, and it begins to actually amplify that capacity in their dream life. So there's just so much evidence when you begin to look at dreams differently. Now, why do we look at dreams as a message? I mean, that is an assumption, we could challenge. And a lot of people have said the reason we do this is because the ancient Greeks, and Plato in particular, conceived of the dream as representative of waking life. The word mimesis is used, which I think means something like imitation or mimic, that it represents or mirrors waking life. So most of us in our pursuit of meaning in the dream, we pursue something that's familiar to us. What does this dream figure pertain to in my waking life? Is it my boss? Is it my... So that we're constantly trying to track the content into our waking life. So because we're encumbered by this historic assumption that dreams are messages, we're always trying to read the message rather than look at them as experiences where the dreamer had a lot to do with what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it could have gone in any number of directions. We don't usually conceive of the dream as a tree. That could have ended up in any number of different directions based on different responses. So I think it's a relatively new approach largely based on the discovery of lucid dreaming, that we can become more conscious in the dream, and why not look at dreams, every dream, as a degree of dream awareness interfacing with the emergent content.
Absolutely. But what typically happens when the dreamer meets what you refer to as the initiation test?
Well, usually it's a breakthrough, and it can be radiant. One of my mentors, Dr. Herbert Puryear, said that in a dream, we either see God, experience God, or we experience what we prefer to God. And I think that's a pretty good basic formula. And when we stop holding on to our reactions to situations, we stop reacting chronically, and we react creatively or with a certain degree of honoring the content, then the separation between us and that ceases to be. And so usually there's an experience of union and reconciliation that has tremendous psychic energy. Just think of all the energy that was... resided in my Benny shadow figure. All of that psychic instinctual energy just wrapped up, just came home to me, at least in that moment. And in
right.
many cases, it's the experience of light itself, which Jung referred to as, what did he say? He said that is an experience common to many mystics and one that is undoubtedly of the greatest significance, because in all times and places it appears as the unconditional thing, which unites in itself the greatest energy and the profoundest meaning. So I found that if you can meet the initiation, you often have an experience of radiance and energy in the dream state.
As you describe that, I'm thinking about where I was listening to something you'd said earlier. I read about it on the articles that you had started meditating in the middle of the night. Why did you start meditating in the middle of the night?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly the first time I did it, but I heard from my friends in Austin, Texas at the time that Edgar Cayce, who was a great clairvoyant, had once said, well, on several occasions, that if a person would meditate or pray for an hour in the middle of the night for 28 days, a complete lunar cycle, he or she would experience, quote, a peace you've never known. So I thought, well, that's a pretty nice promise. So my roommate, Mark Thurston, and I began to meditate in the middle of the night as a customary thing. And I just immediately started having these experiences. So that between meditation in general and positioning it right before the the dream state, it just had an amplified effect on the impact of the dream.
I'm thinking of the meditation you used to do for 2 hours regularly, which is sort of, is there a type of specific type of meditation you did that sort of helped prepare for where you eventually got to?
Well, I've never been a very, I've been a disciplined meditator, but I haven't really attached myself to one particular approach. I mean, sometimes I may use Christian prayers or the rosary or Tibetan mantras, or there's a Siddha yoga mantra I use, so I'm just pretty eclectic in the approach I use. I think the importance is to show up, that practice is everything, and the intent of the heart is more important than the particular method that we embrace. But I do think that positioning meditation before the dream state can have tremendous evolutionary consequences, can accelerate the process of individuation by allowing the dreamer to be more reflective and have a little bit more mindfulness about him when he encounters such things as shadow figures and anima figures who have, as we know, a very powerful agenda with us.
Yes. Do you still meditate in the middle of the night?
Yeah, I did last night.
Okay.
And a wonderful dream with an anima figure. So these things happen to me regularly, and so it's very reinforcing to do it, even though the practice is hard to start. It's just like anything, like working out. It hurts at first, but the consequences, the benefits are tremendous.
Let's repeat the promise, because that impressed me so much when I read it on your website the first time.
Yeah.
That if you did it for...
Well, meditate for 28 days
that
for 1 hour in the middle of the night, you'll know
yes.
a peace you've never known. And then Rumi said, as you may recall this poem, well, a statement by Rumi, he said, what 9 months does for the embryo, 40 early mornings will do for your growing awareness. So,
and yes, that was
yeah.
a phenomenal statement.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm not sure what he meant, but of course, Rumi, didn't always explain himself. But it really does, it stirs something, doesn't it? That kind of promise.
It really does. I mean,
we want to show up. Yeah, we want to show up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How did the idea of what you call, I think, dream reliving get started?
Okay. Well, dream reliving is really a way to try to rectify our insufficient responses to especially distressing dreams, so that instead of just waiting for the next nightmare to come around, we take some proactive measures. I encourage people to relive a distressing dream and to exercise new responses to the content as if one were lucid, and to see what happens, not to try to change them or to try to change the outcome of the dream, but to see what changing your response to them, the characters and situations, will bring about in your own active imagination. And the idea being that we're actually modifying the rigidity of our own reaction to our emergent content by practicing in the waking state. And that this responsiveness and this resilience will carry over into the dream state as well. And sure enough, it does. And I like to position both meditation and a dream reliving right before going back to sleep, say at 3 a.m. Because not only do you have the constructive disengagement of meditation that allows you to view from somewhat at a distance or an aloof position the emotionality of the dream, but also you have a willingness that's been expressed already by the re-engagement in the dream reliving. So once again, we have this tandem path of climbing to the mountaintop and getting clear and getting some perspective, and then a willingness to go back down and struggle meaningfully with the relationships in the dream.
When you referred earlier to how you meet up with, and in a profound way, meet up with, we'll call it the content, or we'll call it whatever within the dream, and you're aware of what's going on, and but I was impacted by the thought of a bit ago where you said, well, that part when I was wrestling to basically saving your life,
mm-hmm.
you weren't lucid, you were dreaming.
Yes.
And but the resources were there during the dream. If it had been lucid, would there have been a different response?
It may have been the same, Elson, but it's also, lucidity can sometimes get in the way of what's happening in the moment. It's just like, you know, if I'm having a meaningful discussion with my wife that's a little heated, I don't need to dissociate into, well, what's going on here? am I dreaming or not? So there are times in our lives, but it's far better to be complete in our body and not be, thinking of the mountaintop. But to bring all of the resources that we've been able to build up in ourselves, and as character, as strength, as courage, all of that, I think, are the fruits we need in the moment, in the incarnational experience of being in relationship.
But I think I'm hearing that you're more likely in the lucid dreaming state, to have what you might refer to as a light experience than you would in just a dream experience.
Yes, that's true. Whenever I become lucid today, I will look for the light in the dream. Usually there's a body of light somewhere in the dream. And if you look for it and you welcome it, it may become an interior experience of ecstasy and radiance. That's how I use my lucidity now, is to try to be available to that.
Right.
Yeah. Or if there's something going on that's problematic, of course, try to respond to that constructively. But my first love is always to be available to that experience.
Understandable. Why is a combination of middle-of-the-night meditation and dream reliving so important to a spiritual seeker, in your opinion?
Well, I think in my reading of Jung, he was often very cautious about advising people to go east. He felt that in the West we had developed to a certain point, for better or worse, and that we could only deal with our ego in a more kind of engaged way and not really presume to get away from that. And so, but personally, I love the East, and I love the meditational practice and the serenity that brings me. So I know that there's a place for that in my life, but also hear the concern that Jung had for that becoming a substitute for bearing the tension of opposites in our existence. I believe that dream reliving is that willingness to say, I want to be here now. I want to be in a relationship. I don't want to just use my serenity and my mountaintop experience to avoid life. But I want to get involved here. I want to reconcile. So I think the meditation gives you the mountaintop, and the dream of living gives you the engagement process that you need to work through things. So you don't get dissociated without realizing it.
Right. Jung would view this tandem practice as being consistent with the path of individuation?
I think so. I think he would. I think it's just inevitable that if we climb the mountaintop, something's going to climb up there and bring us back down for good reason. It's not like it's not going to happen. It's just that might as well cooperate in the process. Right?
Good point.
Yeah.
I like that thinking.
Well, that's my experience. Maybe some people are not so encumbered as I with some psychodynamic debris. But I came into adult life with a lot of unfinished business, so I'm just speaking from my own experience, and maybe not for everyone.
I have a hunch that a lot of us came equally or more so uncovered.
Yeah, probably so.
How does your approach to dreams and dream work relate to the model of doing therapy? Do they overlap?
Well, yes, in particular, I think that this approach to dream work overlaps. I mentioned a while ago how by focusing on the dreamer's response in the dream, we really begin to challenge the dreamer in a positive way to look at his or her response to all relational dynamics in their lives, dreams and waking state. So modern-day therapists who focus on relationships a lot, family therapists, existential humanists who really focus on choice and personal responsibility, all of those good things translate very well into this model, because instead of looking at dreams as having a message, which is kind of a, you know, standing apart from the dream and looking at it as an analyst, we're looking at my role in its creation and my constructive role in this relationship. And I think that that translates beautifully into waking state therapeutic process, where we're looking at, okay, you're married to this person and you're not happy with him, and what can you do? Of course, that is the focus of a modern therapist, is always looking at, well, what is your choice here? What is your freedom? And rather than talking about the content, okay, or the spouse, or the dream character, talking about the agency that the dreamer client has to not so much change them, but make a difference in the relationship. So I think it really helps therapy now to use a relationship approach, a relational approach to dream work.
In the various dreams that really have inspired you and sort of furthered your work, any others you want to share?
Of my own?
Yes.
Well, a lot of my dreams had to do with encountering Jesus early in my 20s and early 30s. I would meditate and then go back to sleep, and then I would have experiences of light, or in some, I had experiences of Jesus. And the first one I had, which really has defined a lot of my work today, was one in which I was lucid, and I saw an open door, and I knew that Jesus was on the other side. And I hoped that he would be there when I got there. So I walked through the door, and I just saw light, white light. And then I saw him standing in the light, beautiful, very striking figure. And he said to me, I felt love pouring from him, and I was just numb, not numb, mute. I couldn't say anything. He said, are you ready to leave the earth yet? I said, no. And then he said, then go out and do what you know to do. Well, I think that dream was a kind of a paradigm, if you will. I'd been meditating a whole lot, just as I said. I've been on the mountaintop. I was thinking, you know, I'm getting up there. I'm doing pretty well. And I didn't realize just how much more work I needed to do on myself. And I was really kind of before the fall at that moment. And so when I had the experience with Jesus and he said, go out and know what, do what you know to do, it became a mantra for me to remind myself that my purpose for being here isn't just to, you know, be holy, but to be whole and to be active. And that's been a hard thing for me, because I could have easily become a monastic type and just, you know, lived in the desert. And so that dream still informs me, even though it's very enigmatic and a little sobering. But I'm still alive, thank God, and yes. Maybe it's because I've been doing a little bit of what I need to do.
And in fact, if I remember correctly, one of your books that's available is, I've not read the book yet, but I'm gathering from the title, it must be about those experiences.
That's right. Some of which are mine. There's a half a dozen of mine, and probably 40 from other people, where they have face-to-face encounters with a being they identify as Jesus or Christ.
Right.
And I just look at it not from any kind of doctrinal standpoint, but phenomenologically, and looking at what are the issues, what's the relationship about, what are these people, what is the impact on their lives? That was the main question I wanted to explore.
In the book you wrote on lucid dreaming, mm-hmm. And at the time it was basically a paper, right?
It was my master's thesis, and then I expanded it somewhat and published it as a little book in 1976 called Lucid Dreaming, Dawning of the Clear Light.
So what have you learned and or experienced since you wrote that? Anything changed?
Well, I think I've just been put more and more focus on here and now living. I think as we get older, we appreciate more relationships and people and how that becomes a religion of sorts, a relinking of ourselves. A friend of mine said, I don't know about God. He's a Jewish friend, and he said, I don't know about God. I don't know, but my religion is people. And I think that all of this lucid work and the experiences of light and all of that just hopefully bring me more into relationship in a way that I can help others and be present fully. And so I guess my whole approach has become much more incarnational than transcendent.
Thinking about that then, let's spend a few minutes talking to about and about. How would you guide others who wanted to at least move toward similar experiences or are now thinking, maybe I need to be on this path of individuation or this path of wholeness, this path of growing. And this kind of sounds like a very super way to maybe make things happen for myself. Well,
yeah.
How would you, and we've got a few minutes left, how would you guide them to sort of get involved?
Well,
first of all, they need to figure out that that's what they have to do.
Yeah. Well, in addition to all the things that Jung recommended, just the work on oneself, either in analysis or in community or a combination thereof, I believe that this tandem practice of meditation and some form of re-engaging the dream as an active participant in dream work and also fantasy or active imagination, that these two things can really be an accelerated path of development. And I don't have time, but I could tie it into Tibetan Buddhist's idea of the accelerated path of yoga pertaining to the whole lucid dreaming, becoming conscious in the dream state, or more active. But practically speaking, if people would just get up in the middle of the night, as I do every night, two or three times spontaneously, and instead of going back to sleep, sit up and meditate a while and pray. Pray the rosary or whatever is part of your spiritual tradition. And then if you have a distressing dream, try to remake it. Not so much from the outside in, but from the inside out. Try to relive it in active imagination and bring forth a new response to it and see what happens in your fantasy. Does it become better? Does it turn out better? And to let that tandem practice trickle into the dream state afterwards. And I think you'll find that you'll have maybe a peace you've never known, but also you may have experiences you've never thought were available to you. I have a web form on my website where people can come and actually share their experiences of doing middle-of-the-night meditation and dream reliving if they'd like to become a part of a loose-knit community. It's not, you know, it's not a commercial thing. It's just a service.
Right.
And I try to oversee that. I've just started it. I try to oversee that forum and provide feedback and share my own experiences and just try to help people out and feel that they're not all alone. So that someone may want to try that if they want to.
And let's give the website again while we're on that topic.
It's called the Dawn Treader Forum. It's just brand new, and I hope in time, I think, will involve quite a few people.
Say it again, the Dawn?
Dawn Treader. It's a word, phrase coming out of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. One of his books is titled The Dawn Treader, which I've always thought was a beautiful metaphor.
Yes, right. That's wonderful. As people have their own growing experiences, their own, does it help to share with each other the dreams that they have? Or will others try to make sense of content that may or may not be there?
I think it's good to share these experiences with people who aren't going to try to rip them apart, tear them apart, analyze them, according to some arbitrary system. and also share it with people that are seeking it as well. I think that sharing spiritual experiences with other people like mine really has a positively infectious effect on us. But, of course, sharing them with the wrong people can be very discouraging, set you back. So find a community, right, and then share, and then let them be infected positively by your experience and vice versa.
Exactly. The what has been your feedback from other Jungians, Jungian analysts, or just Jungians in general, as they hear about this awesome experience that you've been having?
Well, I've been writing about lucid dreams and the light experience for many years, and I have friends who are Jungians. I haven't really been a part of the Jungian community in a bigger way. I really, for some reason, I don't know why, probably because I'm geographically so removed from most cultural centers, I don't have a lot of contact with the Jungian, major Jungian communities. But I am part of the Journey Conference now, and I'm getting support and feedback from some of those people. And I look forward to a dialogue with the Jungians, because I think over the years I've come into more of a balance in my approach to lucidity, and might have something to bring to the Jungian tradition that's more in line with the idea of practice, of a practice that would serve the work.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little more balanced than maybe just a strictly Eastern practice, or strictly Western practice for that matter, but one that balances kind of the contemplative with the active.
Where can someone get a background or training in this unique approach to dreams?
Where can one get a training?
Right, yeah.
Well, I have a course on my website. It's called Incorporating Effective Dreamwork into Your Counseling Practice. It's principally for counselors as a CEU type course. But it's based on my what's called the five-star method. I haven't mentioned that, but I've developed over the last 35 years an approach to dream analysis that I use in therapy, but also with lay audiences, can be used in either. And it's a very systematic five-step approach that applies this co-creative model to dream analysis. It's very easy to use. People find it really exciting. And so it's there on my website. If a person wants to take a course, take that CE course. It involves an instructional video and papers and a PowerPoint. And there are other papers on the site, too, that can be read that would help.
Right. Can we describe, we still have 10 minutes, can we describe the five-star method?
Sure, sure. It starts off with sharing the dream in the present tense, which is a recommendation that Fritz Perls probably was the first to make. I've never heard anyone ascribe the source to anyone but him. But anyway, you share the dream in the present tense as though it's happening right now. That, of course, is very evocative, because when people hear it, they are experiencing it with you vicariously. So it brings the whoever's working with you into a here and now reliving of it. The dreamer himself or herself is, of course, in it when they share it in the present tense. Then after you share it in the present tense, this is still step one. The dreamer and the dream worker or workers, if it's in a group format, just simply shares the feelings that arose during the telling. Just the feelings, one words. And that forms the first step. The second step is you find the dream theme, which is completely content-free. It is just the basic action of the dream narrative. So a theme might be someone is looking for someone, unable to find them, and finally gives up. You know, that may be a three-paragraph-long dream, but you can reduce the dream usually to a very succinct summation, which leaves the content out. So then you move, that's called the dream theme or the dream narrative. And we could, of course, talk at length about why we use that step, but I'm not going to do that now. I'm just laying out the steps. The third step in the five-star method is probably the most important one, and this is the one that deviates from traditional approaches. This is where we look at the dreamer's responses. Where did the dreamer feel, think, behave, in any way respond to the dream content that may have had a determining influence on what happened after that? Assumptions, biases, everything. And so we troubleshoot the dream not from the standpoint of content again, but from the standpoint of simply dreamer responses. And we also engage the dreamer and, you know, how would you have responded differently, do you think? Or what would have happened if you'd done this rather than that? Or isn't it amazing that you were this bold to have... So it's not just a negative. It can be very much honoring the dreamer's constructive responses as well. The fourth step is imagery, and this is where most people come in traditionally. We go into amplification using a Jungian approach, or we may use Fritz Perls dialoguing, but this is where we work with the imagery. The only difference in this step is we see the imagery is not fixed, but something that was unfolding along the dreamer. So a particular appearance of an image is seen in the context of the dreamer's stance or reaction to it. We don't assume it was fixed or frozen by some author somewhere, but we see it as the output or the outcome of the relational stance of the dreamer. The last step is, okay, where do you want to apply this? Where do you think you could work on your responses to this issue in your waking life, and how would you like to work on it in your dream life in the future? If this should happen again, what kind of response would you like to muster? So it's a forward-looking, once again, a response-focused inquiry. And that's the five steps.
That's beautiful. You wear more than one hat. You're a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was intrigued with the fly fisherman life of that you also have.
Uh-huh.
That... And somehow I have in mind that this must give you an incredibly great balance in life.
Well, I really need it. I need to have my feet in the water. I really do.
Nicely said. So, as we wrap up today's conversation, which I so appreciate you joining us for. What advice would you give to those who are listening and trying to figure out what they might be doing with their lives, one way or the other, or not? what words of wisdom would you bring as we conclude?
Well, I would encourage everyone to have a practice. I believe that practice is everything. And I'm often amazed by how few people I know really engage in a disciplined daily, some type of spiritual practice, yoga or meditation or dream work. And that I just feel like if we leave everything as it is, we're just going to become more and more who we already have been. And that the practice allows spirit to work in our lives. We need that.
Yes. Dr. Scott Sparrow, thank you so very much.
Thank you.